I told the latter that I did not intend to partake of meals and did not wish to go to the dining house. But, my lord, all our guests are expected to go to the dining house twice a day. I shall not, I said, politely but firmly. I understood that guests here were free to do what they liked. He bowed and withdrew. Immediately afterwards a servant sent by Narbu came in inquiring whether I was ill. I sent my greetings and the news that I was all right. A minute later another servant sent by Lamo Chun arrived to gather information about my health. I thanked her for her kind interest, adding the message that I was not ill and only required solitude instead of attention. A little while later a third servant came along to learn whether my health permitted me to keep the time fixed for the audience in the palace in the afternoon. I replied that I should certainly come, and had I felt that I would be unable to come I should not have failed to let them know myself. This brought the series of messages to a conclusion. I locked the door and calmly prepared my own breakfast, mixing barley meal with a little butter and a few dried radishes. I had bought sufficient food in the village to last for at least 4 days. Curiously enough, this self-prepared meal did not seem to impair my capacity to think, and I wondered whether this was an actual fact or a mere erroneous impression brought about by auto-suggestion. An hour later I went to join Narbu and a few of his friends. I did not want this good and kind-hearted man to think that he or anyone else in the holy city had done anything to offend me and to make him suspect that I had a discourteous reason for staying away from the meals. 10 minutes before 3 I arrived at the palace for the audience. At that moment I really thought the Prince of Light was a sincere spiritual leader and the head of an occult brotherhood whose supreme goal was to honor the Creator and help the world. The only thing I disliked about him was the extraordinary cloud of majesty with which he seemed to surround himself. But then I thought it might be a mere compromise. He probably felt that he could carry out his work much better if he cloaked himself with such an appearance. And as I am always inclined to look for the substance rather than the shadow, I did not consider this splendor to be a proof of insincerity. Most people do such things on a smaller scale, I thought. At the time when I gave my first broadcast in 1933 I positively detested collars, which I considered both unpractical and idiotic, and yet when I went to see the talk's executive in a continental country I did put on a collar, because I realized that if I appeared in the broadcasting house minus a collar I should never succeed in securing an interview with the talk's executive, and that it would be stupid to sacrifice the opportunity of giving a broadcast for the sake of not putting on a collar. The Prince of Light, I thought, was doing the same thing in a larger scale, and I was prepared to pardon him. I walked down the palace stairs, the entrance was guarded. 4 lifeless servants stood there like so many stone statues. A 5th servant approached, bowed, and lighted a torch. The heavy double door was swung open by other servants, and after a pause of about 2 minutes I was escorted downstairs by not less than 7 servants. Do WN and down we went. Landing followed landing. I had never realized how enormous such an underground building could be. At least 12 landings were behind us when we arrived at the bottom of the staircase situated at a depth of perhaps 100 feet under the main entrance of the palace. Another heavy door was swung open and I found myself in a small hall lit by torches. The time was exactly 3 o'clock. Obviously your paces had been timed very carefully so as to make me arrive downstairs at 3 o'clock sharp, which was the time fixed for the audience. Another servant approached with a golden sprayer and poured on me an abundant supply of perfume. I had certainly not expected to be fumigated in this manner before entering the inner precincts of the palace. but perhaps the prince had established this wise general rule for his own benefit in case a person having genuine Tibetan ideas about hygiene and cleanliness should happen to be invited as a guest by a member of the Holy Brotherhood and secure an audience. While I was being fumigated in this manner, I looked round. 9 small underground passages ran out from the small hall in all directions. They probably connected the palace with the other parts of the underground city. The idea struck me that at least one of the underground passages may have been connected with a place several miles distant to enable the prince or any of his lieutenants to enter and leave the holy city in a secret manner. A system of air pipes justified the assumption that at least 2 of the underground passages measured several miles in length. Each of the passages was guarded by at least 4 servants, some of them probably used for dispatching messages. Wherever the visitor looked, his eyes fell on the lifeless faces of those servants who reminded one of so many corpses just risen from their coffins. The heavy door on the opposite side of the small hall was thrown open. I entered the large entrance hall to the inner part of the palace. From now onwards I only met members of the Brotherhood. No servant, as Narabu told me later, is permitted to enter the inner palace. The large hall measured about 30 by 40 yards. It was illuminated by hundreds of torches stuck into golden sockets in the walls and round the pillars, and fed through pipes with a liquid burning with a smokeless flame. Like many other halls in the holy city, it was connected by air pipes with a large room in the sanitation building, where several dozen servants kept the fans going from about 11 a.m. to 3 a.m. the following day. I was met by 7 members of the Holy Brotherhood in gorgeous robes. A thick black robe of pure silk embroidered with a large number of tsungs was brought, together with 7 silk cushions. Slowly and ceremoniously the 7 cushions were heaped one on another, and then one of the gorgeously dressed brothers stepped on them, unfolded the robe, and got ready to cloak me with it. At that moment the masters of ceremony probably received the greatest shock of their lives. I flatly refused to put on a ceremonial robe of any kind. "If your master is as great as you affirm," I said, politely but firmly, "he must know himself whether I am great or small. I do not want any special dress to improve my appearance when appearing before him." They were dumbfounded. As Narabu told me in magical formulae the evening, I had also broken the rule of absolute silence which must reign in the large underground hall and in the whole left half of the palace which is used by the prince. No one is allowed to utter a word there unless it is in reply to a question or in reference to a command uttered by the Prince of Light. Several other masters of ceremony of a still higher rank were summoned in a hurry. I was surrounded by an ever-increasing crowd of dignitaries who in turn tried to convince me in respectful whispers of the absolute necessity of putting on the black silk gown before stepping into the august presence of the ruler. So much fuss about such a formality. It really was funny. After about 5 minutes' continual whispering, I thought it was useless to take up their time any longer and said with profound respect, "I apologize for having broken your rules, but I thought I had come here for an informal audience and not on solemn official business. Will you please present my respects to Mani Rinpoche?" I turned towards the exit and began to walk out. The crowd of masters of ceremony rushed after me. "You cannot go now," they whispered in a faltering voice. "The audience already began the moment you entered the inner part of the palace." An interrupted audience. Such a thing has never been heard of. "I notice that the whole reception is intended to be mere ceremony," I said coolly. "I have not come to the city to get something, but in order to assist and cooperate of my own free will with sincere spiritual helpers. I have no time for ceremonies. I suggest that one of you puts on that black silk robe and goes through the show on my behalf." "I shall not put it on. This is final," I bowed and turned towards the exit. They had no power to hold me back. At that moment a High Court official dressed in pure white silk came running down from the staircase leading to the upper parts of the palace and literally shouted, "Please stop. The Exalted Jewel will welcome you as you are." Naboo told me in the evening that it was for the first time in its history that someone had shouted in the inner part of the palace. I returned. The seven masters of ceremony walked in front with seven torches, and the brothers of high rank, who had been called to the rescue later on account of this unusual happening, brought up the rear. On the upper landing I was respectfully welcomed by another high official wearing a white silk robe. We entered a richly decorated hall situated on top of the former one. Other court officials approached. They could hardly believe their eyes when they saw a person coming up for an audience dressed in ordinary clothes. They advanced to take my shoes off and replace them by a pair of felt shoes richly adorned with silver ornaments. I told them very politely that I was unwilling to let go of my own shoes, but if they thought they were not clean enough, I had no objection to having them cleaned. For the first time since I had entered the palace, I saw a faint smile. There were two staircases in this second hall. The right one, as Naboo told me later, leading to the private apartments of the court officials, and the left one to the ceremonial rooms where the audience was to be held. An enormously long corridor, very wide and measuring several hundred yards in length, ran out from one of their walls of the hall, and for the first time the idea occurred to me that the underground city might be very much larger than it appeared to be, and that only members who had passed the highest initiations had access to the most secret parts. When we had ascended the staircase, we reached a still more gorgeously decorated hall, this time dimly lit by daylight coming down through the ceiling. Nine other masters of ceremony, led by the court martial, all dressed in white robes richly embroidered with gold, led me upstairs once more in a solemn procession. I realized that I was right near the audience room, as we must have reached the uppermost part of the palace, since brilliant daylight was flooding in through the ceiling. I was met by two members of the Brotherhood, probably acting in the capacity of private secretaries to the prince. The high official and the nine masters of ceremony dressed in white silk bowed and withdrew. I began to talk to the secretaries in a low voice, but they did not answer and put their ringers before their mouths. I decidedly, all these ceremonies, probably destined to impress people with awe and expectation, were lost on me. I considered them rather boring and disrespectfully thought of a circus. Someone passed carrying an occidental easy chair. They seemed to arrange the audience room specially for me. A few minutes later, it was perhaps 3:20, one of the secretaries solemnly announced in whispers, "Will you please come into the presence of the ruler?" I left the anteroom, which was full of costly vases and expensive carpets, and entered a somewhat smaller room where the Exalted Jewel or Prince of Light was seated in a corner. He rose when I entered, met me about halfway, and gave me his left hand with great cordiality. "The left one is nearer to the heart," he said smilingly, in excellent English. "The Prince of Light, as Naboo told me afterwards, speaks and writes six languages perfectly, viz. Tibetan, English, French, Chinese, Hindustani, and Sanskrit." I sat down in the western easy chair that had been specially brought in for the audience and made myself just as comfortable as if I had been in the parlor of a man of small means who would casually invite me to visit his house. "You are a man of great capacity," said the prince, "and you will have fulfilled a great mission in this incarnation. The next few days will be of vital importance to you. The experience and portent of a whole series of lives will be crowded for you into the space of hours. You're called upon to take perhaps the greatest decision you have ever been called upon to make, not only in this life but also in hundreds of previous existences. No one can force your hands, you yourself must make your decision in perfect freedom. He talked like a king or emperor. Every word seemed to have its portent, and he seemed to be fully conscious of the formidable power he wielded. If Naboo was right, I was in the presence of one of the greatest powers on earth. His voice was refined, strong, and beautiful, but had a slightly metallic sound. It was very deep too. He was very tall and had a long white beard. He looked like a mixture of Pythagoras with a slightly Jewish touch and a refined modern Tibetan belonging to the aristocracy of the country. When our eyes met, I had the strange feeling as of something in me fleeing away from him with great eagerness, but it was only an inexplicable reflex, and since I had had so many conflicting and contradictory spiritual experiences ever since I had come to the holy city, I paid no further attention to it. We talked about our respective spheres of activity, my expeditions and my plays. "You have an iron will," he observed, "but this is not enough. Sometimes accomplish things because of your boundless energy. That is not enough. You must acquire the power to make your environment obey you." He mentioned two Sanskrit words to illustrate the difference between wanting a thing and commanding a thing to come your way. He seemed to prompt me to try to put myself on a level with the Creator. I, on the other hand, knew that my greatest asset in life had been a capacity to live fully, to be a creature, a powerful creature in my own way, but yet a child of the Creator, and I had never tried to be like the Maker by commanding things to come my way. We then talked about spiritual mistakes. He said that they did not matter. If a man stumbles and falls, he seemed to imply, he would rise again. It occurred to me that there was at least one dreadful mistake in the spiritual realm. If man throws his soul away, he cannot make amends for it. He cannot take it back afterwards. There are mistakes which are fatal for all eternity. If a man jumps from a skyscraper, he may undo in a few seconds all he has built up in a lifetime, I thought. I rather disliked his saying that a mistake never mattered, for one can make amends for it. I knew that there are mistakes for which making amends is impossible. I felt as if this had been said to rush my decision, and immediately the lion temperament in me began to assert itself. From spiritual mistakes, the conversation drifted to the question of power. "You could become all powerful," he observed meaninglessly. "At what price?" I asked. "That you must discover for yourself," he answered. We talked about his brotherhood. He illustrated how impersonal he was. The individual often disappeared before his eyes. He then only saw principles at work. And great principles they were. Guests did not always realize this. Sometimes guests come here who have sacrificed everything for doing so and who go hungry for weeks to be able to come here. "Let them be hungry, it is good for them to be hungry," he said with cold emphasis. I looked at him as he sat there in his costly robes. He seemed to sense what was going on within me. "I hope you do not misunderstand me," he added, and changed the topic. Our conversation gradually touched deeper problems, such as the contrast between East and West, bloody wars and catastrophes of nature, and how all these things had deeper causes. He even touched on the problem of politics, dictatorships, and mass rule, and seemed to be against sport. As I never touch in my books and lectures on any problem which is directly or indirectly connected with politics, I shall withhold the details. I thought I had already overstepped the time allowed for the audience, and meant to close it by making a few polite remarks about my refusal to put on the ceremonial robe made of black silk. Then he smiled for the first time. "You are the first person who has ever entered this part of the palace in clothes like this. I hope you will now realize how little value we really attach to matters of pomp and circumstance. I mentioned Coriolanus, by Shakespeare, and found that he knew it very thoroughly, since he expressed his opinion in a very circumstantial way and also gave a considerable number of details showing that he must have read the play several times. I sincerely wished I could believe him, but I couldn't. Suddenly I felt that many people were waiting outside as the time allotted to them had arrived. I positively knew they were waiting. As explained before, the atmosphere of the city developed these faculties in a strange manner. I rose and wished to withdraw, but he requested me to stay, saying that he greatly appreciated our conversation. I thanked him and sat down again. I casually mentioned my future plans and was anxious to find out what he would do under such and such circumstances. I never give advice to anybody, he said. I then broached the subject of religious ceremonies, and after having talked for a while about these matters, I asked his permission to attend divine service in the temple on the condition that I should be present as a visitor and on the understanding that my attending it should not imply any obligation to the occult brotherhood. He granted permission, adding that for the first time in the history of the temple I would be allowed to attend a service without putting on a black silk robe. Furthermore, as a special favor, I was also authorized to visit the library room in the residential buildings where guests who have not yet become members of the Brotherhood are practically never admitted. I thanked him and withdrew, respectfully greeted. A major black silk robe is worn at special festivals, and at the audiences of the prince. A minor black silk robe is worn at ordinary divine services. Only the ruler can grant exceptions by all the court officials and masters of ceremony. When I passed outside the many persons whose receptions I had delayed by the excessively long audience, I left the palace and walked back to the guest house. I sent a servant to Naobu, informing him that I had had a long and interesting audience with the ruler, that I should not come to dinner but would attend divine service the same evening, since I had obtained permission to do so from the exalted jewel. When the servant came to announce that dinner was ready, I let him repeat his mechanical formula several times, then I bolted the door and prepared my own meal. After dinner I slept for several hours, and about 10 minutes before 11 o'clock in the evening joined Naobu. We both walked over to the temple building to attend the daily service in the temple. I briefly told him about the audience, but he seemed to have been informed of it already. I hope you are convinced by now that the exalted jewel is a powerful spiritual leader, he observed. Yes, I replied, holding back the opinion that I still had to find out about him the most important fact, viz. Whether he served the cause of light or the cause of shadow. The whole evening I had been in the grip of grave doubts as to the real nature of the whole Brotherhood of Light. It was dark night when we passed the circular wall surrounding the shaft in the center of the holy city. This shaft must be very deep, I observed. How do you know it is a shaft? Asked Naobu. I have explored it a little, I answered. He seemed greatly surprised. It is immeasurably deep, he observed, but no one except the Prince of Light and a few of the highest initiates who are called Lords of Compassion know where it leads to. Anyone who would find out where it leads to and what it is used for would have to die. There are such secrets. Who would kill him? No one. He would die automatically the following night. We arrived at the temple building and descended the staircase. The small hall in front of the golden double door leading to the temple was dimly lit by torches held by servants, none of whom was allowed to enter the holy lakang. There were several servants helping the members to take off their shoes. They knelt down before them and washed their feet. Services had to be attended barefooted. Other servants sprayed the naked feet of the hierophants with an abundant supply of perfume. I could not help smiling. A master of ceremonies dressed in black silk distributed the ceremonial robes to the temple goers. They were somewhat simpler than the ones I had seen in the palace, but somewhat smaller and embroidered with silver. When I looked at these people going in such robes to the service, I thought of a requiem said in a Catholic church. Court officials had informed the Master of House of God. Ceremonies that I was allowed to enter without putting on a black silk robe and without taking off my shoes. It was quite an exceptional thing that such a permit had been granted by the ruler. Later, during the service, I must have looked like a bright spot in the darkness. Everybody else was dressed in black silk. I was the only person present who wore a chupa of the cheapest kind, which was made of cotton and remarkably light in color. After having been thoroughly fumigated by a servant armed with a perfume sprayer, I passed the outer door of the temple. It was a few minutes to 11. Another master of ceremonies, armed with a substantial-looking stick inlaid with gold and precious stones and having a human skull at the top, approached and informed me in whispers that it was strictly forbidden to talk or even to whisper inside the temple, and that it was considered a serious offense even to look at the other participants in the service. He hoped I would comply with these rules. The alternative, he added this with the greatest politeness, was a respectful and humble request to leave the temple immediately. He bowed almost obsequiously, and I passed the inner door of the temple. I should like to mention in this connection that bows in the holy city are quite different from the usual Tibetan greetings. People in the city practically never raise their folded hands to their foreheads, mouths, and hearts, which is frequently seen else nowhere, and also the Tibetan prostration commonly called Kyagchag is only used during divine service in the holy city. The House of God measured about 25 yards by 40. There were 9 large doors in the 3 walls opposite and right and left from the entrance. They stood wide open, and one could see that they gave access to 9 underground tunnels at least several hundred yards long and running out slightly downhill into the bowels of the earth as far as the eye could see. A kind of altar with a perpetual light burning on it stood in the center of the temple, and 4 long tables ran out from this center forming a large cross. The Hierophants sat at these tables. I wanted to sit near Nabu, but the places were assigned by masters of ceremony and no participant in the service had the right to choose his place himself. About 200 members were present already when I took the seat assigned to me. The walls of the temple were adorned with inscriptions in Tibetan, and I spent quite a few minutes in reading them. I understood some of them, but failed to understand others. One of them read, "Give your soul to the master and he will show you the light." I thought of a man buying a cat in a bag. Another one read, "Distrust your brain. Deep understanding is beyond intelligence." This only increased my desire to trust my brain. Another inscription ran, "Blessed be you who suffer, come to me and I will give you relief." And another, "Everything is unreal, only my own words are real." This inscription, I thought irreverently, was none too modest. The service began by the ringing of bells. The effect of this peal of bells rung far away in the underground tunnels was prodigious. Then a very high initiate wearing a costly white silk robe solemnly walked up from the northern wall of the temple towards the central altar. His train was held by several minor initiates. He performed queer rites and movements, his assistants touching the ground behind him with their heads most of the time. The audience alternately rose to their feet like a well-trained body of soldiers, then sat down again or touched the ground with their heads. These 3 poses alternated in fairly rapid succession. Bells were rung from time to time, and incense was burned repeatedly. On one occasion the priest walked round the altar 7 times, swinging the incense burner all the time. Towards the end of the service, Small pills made of rice were consecrated by the priest and the members of the brotherhood, one by one, walked up to the altar and each took a consecrated pill from a golden plate and swallowed it with great devotion, walking back to his seat immediately afterwards.